Good evening and welcome. This is the reading of the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, Juneteenth, 2025. There was no monitor published today because of the Juneteenth holiday, but there are updated stories that I will read. So let's start with what Pakistan's military gained from the conflict with India. Popularity. India and Pakistan are both on campaigns to shape the global narrative about last month's armed conflict. But within Pakistan, no such scrambling is required as the country rallies around its powerful military. By Hassan Ali, Rawalpindi, Pakistan. 9 months ago, Pakistan sent troops onto the streets of the capital, Islamabad. Civilian protesters, outraged by the military's continuous meddling in politics, were pelting police with stones and calling for revolution. Security officials had shoot-to-kill orders. Now, those same streets are calm, their walls plastered with posters singing the army's praises. This shift from condemnation to celebration dates from last month's brief but intense confrontation with India, when the Pakistani military claimed to have shot down 5 Indian fighter jets. The military's surprise triumph sparked a wave of nationalist fervor that has united Pakistanis from all walks of life. It is hard to predict how long this sense of unity will last, or to what extent it will derail long-term efforts by civilian politicians to curb the army's influence in Pakistani politics. But it's not even clear exactly how many jets Pakistan shot down. Islamabad and Delhi have offered competing accounts of the conflict, which ended in a ceasefire on May 10th. And both have tasked international delegations with trying to wrest control of the narrative. What is evident is that the Pakistani army has emerged a victor at home, well-placed to consolidate its already immense domestic power. Defense spending went up by more than 20% in last week's budget, even while overall spending was cut by 7%. Meanwhile, Army Chief Syed Asim Munir has become only the second officer in Pakistan's history to attain the 5-star rank of Field Marshal. He is currently on an official visit to the United States, another sign of his rising influence. When conflict first erupted between the nuclear-armed neighbors, Indian commentators were arguing that it was a really excellent time to attack because the Pakistani army was so unpopular, says Gul Bukhari, a Pakistani political commentator. But when a husband and wife are at one's throats and they get attacked from outside, they will come together. And come together they have. A vicious loop. A poster of Field Marshal Munir hangs on a towering pylon beside a public park in Rawalpindi. "We're ready," it says. "Don't test our resolve." Though the message is ostensibly aimed at India, which Pakistan claims it defeated in the 4-day conflict, it resonates too with Tehreek-e-Insaf, the political party led by jailed former Premier Imran Khan. Mr. Khan, who remains Pakistan's most popular leader and blames the army for his ouster in April 2022, stands accused of masterminding a series of riots in May 2023, in which his supporters reportedly attacked military installations across Pakistan. He also accuses the army of rigging the 2024 general election to install a puppet administration, a claim supported by international media and made credible by the Army's track record of political meddling. In the nearly 8 decades since Pakistan came into existence, it has experienced 33 years of direct military rule. The rest of the time, the Army has wielded influence from the shadows, acting as a power broker in the country's fragile democracy. By targeting Mr. Khan and thousands of his supporters, the military sparked an unprecedented public backlash and demands for systemic reform. But in both India and Pakistan, in times of war, the jingoistic urge takes over, says Shuja Nawaz, a distinguished fellow of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank in Washington, D.C. The media becomes captive to whatever message they're getting from the authorities, and they magnify it and feed it back into a kind of vicious loop. Still, the systematic issues remain. The Army's role in Pakistan. The Army's overwhelming influence in domestic affairs has its roots in the colonial period, when Punjabi Muslims, considered a martial race by the British rulers of India, formed the backbone of the British Indian Army. When Pakistan became an independent country in 1947, the army emerged as the new nation's strongest institution, prevailing over civilian leaders, many of whom had migrated from India. Over time, the military's influence over both the judicial and executive branches of government has become an open secret in Pakistan. It also controls much of the country's wealth. The military has crowded out the private sector, says Mr. Nawaz. It has taken over the national highways. It has taken over transportation. Those are very visible signs of the military's footprint. If the military is enjoying a boost in its popularity now, argues local political analyst Hamid Mir, it is because the army was performing its constitutional function during the clash with India, instead of meddling in areas beyond its ambit. When they were doing their real job, the people appreciated them, he says. This is a golden opportunity for them. They should stop interfering in politics. Many analysts would call that wishful thinking. For one, Pakistan's biggest champion of unfettered civilian rule is expected to remain in jail for the foreseeable future. Mr. Khan is certainly a little less relevant to the way things are shaping up post-conflict, says veteran journalist and former government spokesperson Fahd Hussein. His main opponent, the military establishment, is much more popular, much more powerful. That shrinks the options that he has. Next story. Forget Europe. Russian travel agents say, how about a North Korean resort? With the West now inhospitable to them, Russian tourists are finding new holiday opportunities in North Korea, Afghanistan, and other unlikely spots. By Fred Weir, Moscow. During the Cold War, an exotic foreign vacation for a Russian tourist usually consisted of a visit to a Soviet satellite state, such as Bulgaria or Poland, assuming they could get all the right documentation. The collapse of the USSR wrenched open the entire world in a very real way for the formerly isolated Russian population. In subsequent years, Russians were able to flock to the sites of London and Berlin, the cafes of Paris and Rome, the beaches of Turkey, and even Florida, as the Putin era brought a touch of prosperity for the average person, possibilities expanded, tour agencies proliferated, and millions of Russians began taking international travel for granted. But geopolitical events are once again limiting their choices. Since Russia's annexation of Crimea 11 years ago, exacerbated by the invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago, Russians have found it increasingly difficult to obtain visas, make payments abroad, or even find airline connections to formerly favored European destinations. Recently, growing numbers of Russians have been heading for places that remain off-limits to all but the most adventurous Western travelers, including North Korea, Iran, and Afghanistan. The era of mass tourism for Russians is very young, yet it keeps transforming, says Mikhail Maltsev, president of the Ural Tourism Association based in Yekaterinburg. One constant is that Russians really like to travel and are willing to put a lot of their resources and efforts into it. Much better to have a Russian passport. Anton Krotov is one of Russia's best-known travel bloggers, having visited 140 countries and written 67 travel books. He carries only a Russian passport, which may be an inconvenient document for travel to Western countries these days, but he argues is very well regarded in many parts of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. A lot of people seem pleased and fascinated to meet a Russian, he says. There are places, especially in Asia, where it's probably much better to have a Russian passport than an American one. International travel can be complicated for Russians. Secondary sanctions make Russian payment systems unusable, even in some relatively friendly countries like Turkey. But Russian tour operators have been looking for new places where Russian passports and ruble payments are welcome, and which offer interesting shopping opportunities, exotic historical sites, and even luxury beach vacations. Russians can find the last in North Korea, which has repurposed a former missile testing site into a vast seaside resort zone set to open this month. The zone will boast 54 hotels, 2 miles of beachfront, and a wide range of shops, restaurants, and other attractions. It's not clear where all those tourists are supposed to come from, but several Russian agencies are already gearing up to provide package tours for famously beach-loving Russians, for whom North Korea is relatively accessible by air or rail link from the Pacific city of Vladivostok. Since North Korea lifted its long pandemic shutdown just over a year ago, Russian travel agency Vostok Intour has brought over 1,000 Russians to the Hermit Kingdom on organized tours, a four-day, all-inclusive train tour out of Vladivostok visits several cities and costs just under $1,000. You can only go to North Korea in a tightly organized group tour, says Mr. Krotov, but for Russians it's a bit like a time machine. You get a glimpse of how we used to live 80 years ago in the Stalin era. Everything is controlled. You're always under surveillance. You can never go off on your own and only see what you are shown. Dmitry Gordiev, who recently participated in a tour to North Korea, told the Mir 24 TV network that it was one of the most exciting trips he has ever taken. Why? because you find yourself in a completely closed country. They don't even have the internet. Apart from our group of around 70 Russians, there were absolutely no foreigners. We were the only guests in a giant 38-floor hotel, he said. You're not in prison, of course, but you can't go outside. Experts say that while Russians certainly notice the regimented nature of the society around them, they don't chafe at it as much as Westerners might. Travelers report good quality services, apparently friendly people, beautiful scenery, and broad, empty beaches. There is every possibility for North Korea to become a major destination for Russian mass tourism, especially beach and wellness tours, says Mr. Maltsev. Revisiting an old war. Another emerging destination for Russians is Afghanistan, which has become legally accessible since the Russian government formally lifted the Taliban-run country's terrorist status in April. Several Russian tour operators were already organizing trips to the country via Turkey and the Gulf states, but experts say direct tours from Russia will begin soon. The Taliban are actually very tourist-friendly, and the most dangerous thing in the country these days is the road traffic, says Mr. Krotov, who has been to Afghanistan several times and is now consulting for Russian travel agencies looking to start direct tours. One particular group has a definite interest in visiting Afghanistan, now that it's peaceful and relatively Russia-friendly. Russian veterans of the USSR's 9-year war in Afghanistan. Franz Klintsevich, a Russian parliamentarian and Afghan war vet, says the country holds many memories, and there are former battlegrounds, graves, and even monuments to Soviet troops that are worth visiting. He says he's been there several times as chair of the Official Council of Afghanistan Veterans. He has found that the Taliban respects Soviet war memorials, and the people are generally patient and respectful of Russian visitors. There is no proper infrastructure for tourists, so Afghanistan is probably not attractive for most Russians, he says, but with a bit of organization, I think a lot of our veterans would be pleased to go. Their average age is in the mid-60s now, and I know there are feelings of nostalgia, a yearning for more perspective, maybe closure. Until the Israeli airstrikes last week, Iran was another destination on which Russian tour companies had been setting their sights. Mr. Maltsev, who has been there several times, says Iranian authorities had been making efforts to attract Russian tourists, and new air routes were planned. Iran had been developing a reputation for being completely safe, very affordable, and increasingly accessible by air from Russia, he says. It is still unclear what long-term impact the current war will have on Russian tourism in Iran. The future world for Russian tourists probably mirrors the geopolitical BRICS plus global order being championed by Russian diplomacy, say experts. Some doors close, but others open, says Mr. Maltsev. The world is a very big place. Next story. Taiwanese rethink China travel as Beijing raises stakes for separatist speech. China's campaign to unify Taiwan with the mainland is now extending to a crackdown on Taiwanese who Beijing deems pro-independence. By Anne Scott Tyson, Beijing. Until a few years ago, Summer Chen traveled often from her home in Taiwan to China, venturing across the Taiwan Strait for her job as a journalist and sightseeing with her husband. "We enjoyed the culture, history, and beautiful scenery," she recalls. No more, Ms. Chen, who founded a fact-checking organization that debunks Chinese disinformation, now shuns such trips for fear that Beijing could label her a Taiwan independence supporter and arrest her. While China's expanding military drills around Taiwan often capture media headlines, Beijing is waging a less visible legal and psychological campaign that nonetheless feels more intimidating to many Taiwanese. In recent years, the Chinese government has dramatically broadened its definition of what constitutes Taiwan independence activities. They now include any conduct seeking to separate Taiwan from China and acts that deny the reality that Taiwan is part of China or suppress support for unification. This wide net covers a vast array of political, economic, and cultural expression. Last year, Beijing also issued new punishment guidelines under China's 2005 anti-secession law, allowing the death penalty for Taiwan independence activists. These changes put younger people, such as Ms. Chen, who are more likely to support Taiwan's autonomy from Beijing, in a difficult position. "We all feel tense, and we won't travel on the mainland," says Ms. Chen from Taipei. "We totally avoid changing planes in China or Hong Kong." Beijing shifts its red line. In the past, Beijing used a narrower definition of Taiwan independence, focusing on a formal declaration of independence by Taipei. China's Communist Party-led government has never ruled Taiwan, but has claimed the island for decades and has vowed to retake it by force if necessary. Yet, polls show that most of the 23 million people who live in Taiwan, a self-governing democracy, favor the status quo of autonomy. With the rising popularity of Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, which advocates self-determination and has ruled Taiwan since 2016, Beijing has grown more concerned about the island's slow political drift. The DPP holds that Taiwan is de facto independent, so formally declaring independence is unnecessary. To counter this trend, Chinese leader Xi Jinping has targeted what he calls incremental independence moves by Taiwan, including any efforts by individuals or groups to restrict ties with mainland China. In the past year, his government went so far as to publish a list of so-called Taiwan independence diehards and set up a tip line calling on the public to report alleged thugs and accomplices who support the island's independence. In essence, Mr. Xi is signaling that Beijing will not tolerate continued lack of progress toward unification. "Today, anything can be interpreted as Taiwan independence," says a Taiwan government official, who spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to grant media interviews. "That is dangerous. Avoid unnecessary travel. China's widening legal net has already ensnared individuals such as Taiwanese political activist Yang Chiyuan, who was detained in 2022 and sentenced in 2024 to 9 years in a mainland prison on charges of separatism. In February, Taiwan-based publisher Li Yanhe was convicted of inciting separatism by a Chinese court and given a 3-year prison term. Mr. Li, who was born in China but has lived in Taiwan since 2009, was detained while traveling in China in 2023. As of May, 89 Taiwanese were missing or detained in China, according to Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council. Given what it called a serious threat to the personal safety of Taiwanese, Taipei issued a warning last year advising citizens to avoid unnecessary travel to mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau. The government also encouraged travelers to sign up in advance on a new online travel registry to speed its response to any incidents. Rising safety risks have contributed to a steady reduction in the number of Taiwanese working in China in recent years, a trend also driven by trade tensions, the pandemic, and the slowing Chinese economy. Trips by Taiwan citizens to mainland China have plateaued at around 200,000 per month, well below the 2019 pre-pandemic level, and have trended downward in the past year, chipping away at Taiwan's democracy. China's legal crackdown on separatists from Taiwan is closely tied to Beijing's broader campaign to compel unification, says Julia Famolero, a lecturer in Asian studies at the University of Hawaii. Beijing seeks to employ media warfare, legal warfare, and psychological warfare as part of a strategy to undermine Taiwan's democracy and encourage self-censorship, she says. Just as China's Coast Guard and Navy conduct large-scale exercises to simulate a military blockade of Taiwan, Beijing has also targeted Taiwan businesses linked to politicians who seek to bolster the island's resilience, she says. Such events represent Beijing's coordinated efforts to undermine and isolate Taiwan, she says. In March, Taiwan's president, Lai Ching-te, announced 17 strategies to counter China's threats, including raising awareness of the mounting legal and travel risks. Taiwan's people must unite to defend our sovereignty, uphold our free and democratic way of life, and resolutely oppose annexation of Taiwan by China, he stressed. Ultimately, Taiwan's future will depend upon the resilience of its people, Dr. Lai and others, other officials say. To defend our country is our own responsibility, says Charles Liao, Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office, Taiwan's de facto consulate in Boston. If we don't show our resolve, we cannot expect anyone to help. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. U.S. economy faces reckoning as some immigrants avoid workplaces. Uncertainty caused by policy shifts and arrests is taking a toll on America's workplaces, making many immigrants with and without legal status hesitant to go to work. By Patrick Johnson, Sarah Matusek, and Ali Martin. Tybee Island, Georgia, Denver, and Los Angeles. 10 days after raids by federal immigration officials in Los Angeles set off a national protest movement, a Hispanic woman walks through the city's Canoga Park neighborhood. She says she won't give her name for concern that she might risk trouble for herself or others. In fact, she won't say much, but the quiet streets evoke a broader phenomenon sweeping the United States. Right now, we're hiding, she says, noting that she's a legal resident in a community where many others do not have government permission to live and work. We don't want to stand out. As President Donald Trump pursues his promised mass deportation campaign, worksite arrests in both rural areas and big cities are raising questions around the future of the U.S. workforce and its economy, long reliant on immigrants both in and out of lawful status. In one of its latest crackdowns, federal agents said they had arrested 84 unauthorized immigrants on June 17th at the Delta Downs racetrack near Vinton, Louisiana. While continuing to target Democratic-led cities, Mr. Trump has also noted that his immigration tactics are taking a very good long-time workers away from the farm, hotel, and leisure sectors. It's unclear what effect, if any, the immigration crackdown has had so far on economic indicators. But while the impact of President Trump's deportation sweep may take time to register, uncertainty caused by policy shifts, muscular arrests, and deportations is already taking a toll. In a series of switchbacks over the past week, the Trump administration first announced ramped-up arrests of unauthorized immigrants. Then, after some back and forth, it told Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to pause arrests at farms, hotels, and restaurants, reported the New York Times. On Sunday, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins posted on X that she fully supports deportations of every illegal alien. Reversals on reversals. As of this week, the Trump administration has reportedly reversed prior orders to spare farms and other businesses from raids. All this comes as the administration is pushing self-deportation and making arrests at sensitive sites like immigration courts. Worksite raids aren't new, and even if the administration's reported goal of 3,000 arrests a day were reached, and those arrests became deportations, the country would fall far short of removing all of America's estimated 13.7 million unauthorized immigrants in 4 years. Unauthorized immigrants now make up almost one of every 10 U.S. workers, according to the Pew Research Center. More than one quarter of those are in the construction and agriculture industries. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy estimated that unauthorized workers paid $96.7 billion in taxes in 2022, including $19.5 billion in federal income tax, the total that all Americans paid in federal income taxes in 2022 was $2.1 trillion. Last year, unauthorized immigrants paid about $24 billion in Social Security taxes, despite being ineligible for benefits, according to a study published this week by the Penn-Wharton Budget Model. If continued over the next 10 years, the Trump deportation policy would raise Social Security programs' deficits by $133 billion. Over 30 years, by $884 billion, the study said. From the berry fields of Oxnard, California, to a meatpacking plant in Omaha, Nebraska, reports of recent targeted worksite arrests have kept immigrants and their advocates on high alert. When hiding becomes a new normal. In Donna, Texas, farmer Nick Billman now arrives at the fields alone, even though he says his field hands have legal work papers. Zero workers have shown up since ICE began its latest raids in the Rio Grande Valley, he says. What's happening now is the rumors that even if you have a work visa or are working on citizenship, you're going to get rounded up with the rest of them, says Mr. Billman. It's making people sit at home. Still, across the country, American employers and immigrant employees have begun speaking up about the broader consequences of mass deportation. Their concerns point to practical issues that the U.S. has long neglected to reconcile regarding labor markets, border security, and public attitudes on immigration. We've never really figured out, as a nation, what to do with nativist sentiment that says we need to restrict immigration, and the reality on the ground, which is that immigrants are doing a lot of work, says Leticia Saucedo, professor at the University of California, Davis School of Law. Now, Professor Saucedo says, the administration is grappling with the potential economic impact of Mr. Trump's deportation goals, which helped reelect him. Farmers like Robert Dickey, a Republican state representative in Georgia, are some of the strongest supporters of the GOP agenda. So far, Representative Dickey's workers who are here on seasonal work visas are showing up at his orchards and timber stands, but that, he understands, could change. It's essential that we make our agriculture industry competitive, he says. To do that, you have got to have this workforce. Where policy meets the punch clock. His conundrum is part of a sustainability question, as the unique skills and work ethic of immigrant labor are meeting key demands in the U.S. economy, says Austin Kocher, an immigrant enforcement expert at Syracuse University in New York. The whiplash of the last few days, Professor Kocher says, illustrates the tension within the White House itself about how to approach immigration enforcement policy. When you have Republican supporters who are business owners, working class people, construction workers, working against pressure from the Stephen Miller and Tom Homan wing, who are saying, deport everyone. Modern worksite enforcement can be traced back to 1986, when President Ronald Reagan signed the Immigration Reform and Control Act. It outlined what would become a major immigration legacy for the Republican president, allowing an estimated 3 million people to gain legal status. The act introduced civil and criminal penalties for employers who knowingly hired unauthorized workers. Separately, it's illegal for immigrants to use false documents for work. Issues with the document verification process, however, have contributed to the ongoing hiring of unauthorized immigrants. While the Trump White House has often criticized the Biden administration for historic highs in illegal border crossings, many have been here for decades. Unauthorized immigrants made up 3.3% of the total U.S. population as of 2022, according to the Pew Research Center. Worksite enforcement remains a cornerstone of our efforts to safeguard public safety, national security, and economic stability, said Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs with the Department of Homeland Security, in an email to the Monitor. Worksite raids can be useful for broader enforcement, supporters say. Jerry Robinette, a former official for ICE's Homeland Security investigations under the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, said past crackdowns on large companies have led to hundreds of arrests, but also a voluntary response from a lot of industry wanting to self-disclose to avoid an ICE HSI investigation of their company and their employees. So far, it's unclear how often unauthorized immigrants are avoiding going to work, a step that jeopardizes their ability to support their families. Many immigrants are also adjusting to losing their temporary lawful status under this administration. That includes Herman, a Venezuelan in Boston, who gained temporary protected status under the Biden administration before President Trump's team moved to end it, though litigation may continue. Still, he holds a work permit through his pending application for political asylum and says he pays taxes on his $15 an hour night shifts at a factory. Once homeless, Herman can now afford rent with his job. He brings along a backpack full of immigration documents. I have a lot of fear about going to work, says Herman, who asked to omit his last name over deportation concerns, but obviously I need to work to be able to survive. He says that he's holding out hope for better opportunities for immigrants after this administration. My American dream remains the same. For now, however, President Trump says he has urged ICE to conduct raids in larger sanctuary cities like Boston, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York that limit cooperation with federal immigration authorities to protect unauthorized immigrants. When workers don't return to work. But that is not keeping the raids from resonating to all parts of the immigrant community, says Andrew Stettner, Director of Economy and Jobs at the Century Foundation, an independent think tank in Washington. Usually, ICE will carry out raids just enough to push people underground and take bad wages, he says. But they will ultimately stay here and the economy will function. We're now pushing past that. We're going into unprecedented territory. While research suggests that immigrants provide a net benefit to the economy, analysts also note that prior immigrants and native-born workers qualified for low-skilled jobs are most likely to face negative wage effects from immigration. Meanwhile, some immigrants are exploited under a system that tacitly accepts large populations of unauthorized people. Gilberto Alvarez, for now, is an employer who is left holding down the fort, the manager of a Denny's restaurant south of Los Angeles. He has watched those whom he believes to be federal agents gather in his parking lot. Employees were scared, he says. Some took the week off and have yet to return to work. Mr. Alvarez and the other managers are picking up the slack, and the restaurant will be okay for a few months, he says, if he manages it properly. But if this goes on for longer, he'll be in a bad spot. However, some immigration enforcement experts argue that partial slowdowns or increased pressure from agricultural or hospitality interests could influence the administration's future actions. Representative Dickey, the Central Georgia peach farmer, recently met with agricultural Secretary Rollins during a trip to Washington to lobby for hurricane relief aid and a long-term solution for immigrant labor. The administration hasn't done anything to hurt us yet, but we're hoping they can do something to help, he says. Los Angeles, which once welcomed Orfelinda Martinez with open arms, is now a place where spotters keep an eye out for immigration agents. Ms. Martinez sought asylum 30 years ago from Guatemala. Today, she is a U.S. citizen living with her sister just north of Los Angeles. The people in her community are mostly immigrants and mostly Hispanic. They work at the nearby ranches or as landscapers, babysitters, housekeepers, restaurant workers, or construction workers. Her immigration experience years ago was positive, she says. The officer who worked with her on citizenship treated me like family, she says. Still, she keeps risks to a minimum these days, like others in her community. Even though she's here legally, she says, if we don't have to go out, we don't go out, just in case. It's not just their future, but also the labor market in bedrock industries that hangs in the balance. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the Print Disabled. Next story. Lights, camera, tax credits? Sagging Hollywood draws attention of California and Trump. California's new state budget doubles tax incentives for the film industry to help Hollywood, as other countries and states lure production away. President Trump is also floating efforts to help. By Allie Martin, Los Angeles. When President Donald Trump turned the spotlight on Hollywood last month with talk of a protective tariff, he drew attention to a challenge of rising urgency for California, the ongoing exodus of its vaunted film and TV production industry to other states and nations. The Golden State has a deep well of talent, from writers and makeup artists to grips and agents, but faces steep competition from a global marketplace for production. And in Los Angeles in particular, an identity as the entertainment capital of the world is at stake. That identity is worth fighting for, says Colleen Bell, executive director of the California Film Commission, which administers a tax credit to incentivize production. A newly passed state budget expands those incentives for the industry. Creativity flourishes when people feel free. That's one of our greatest values here in California, she says. From Hollywood to Silicon Valley and the exploration of AI, the world's fourth largest economy is built on creativity. It's all intertwined, and it continues to deliver economic rewards and cultural rewards. Why does it matter where productions take place? In the early 1900s, movie studios established themselves in Hollywood, which was annexed into Los Angeles in 1910. Over time, studios fanned out to other parts of Los Angeles and adjacent cities, but Hollywood remains synonymous with movie making. The motion picture industry is a small percentage, 1.4% of the state's economic output, but California still leads the country in entertainment employment. Los Angeles is also the industry's business center. L.A. has a unique ecosystem of everyone and everything needed for a successful production. I just have to call and they don't have to move, says Sanjay Sharma, who teaches entertainment finance at the University of Southern California. It's important to preserve the ecosystem, he says, because it works. The skilled crafts that underpin entertainment are also at risk of being lost, says David Offenberg, an entertainment finance professor at Loyola Marymount University. Below-the-line workers like costume designers, set decorators, and sound engineers can make or break a production. Encouraging local production, he adds, keeps those crafts alive. And if we lose that craftsmanship, we may never get it back. What are the incentives being offered in California? California's tax incentives are capped at $750 million per year statewide, more than double the previous cap, thanks to a budget plan passed June 13th. The state uses a formula based on job creation to grant the credits and excludes the highest paid above the line positions, such as lead actors, producers, and directors. It's about jobs, 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 says Ms. Bell. Those jobs peaked in 2022 when streaming companies like Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery were creating content to feed pandemic viewing and entice new subscribers. But revenue didn't keep pace with production, which eventually slowed. Then in 2023, writers and actors went on strike for nearly 4 months, bringing production to a halt. The resulting wins for the unions increased production costs, which were already higher in Los Angeles, where the cost of living and labor exceeds that in most of the U.S. Those jobs have yet to bounce back. An analysis of California's creative economy finds employment in the film and TV industry is 25% below its 2022 peak, despite adding 15,000 jobs in the past year. And between 2010 and 2023, California's share of industry employment went from 54% to 46%. At the local level, LA Mayor Karen Bass aims to encourage production in the city with a recent executive order that reduces red tape and lowers costs. Governor Gavin Newsom has made tax incentives a priority during his administration, pushing for the just-passed boost. Critics say the tax credit is a misplaced priority when the state faces a steep funding shortage. Along with LA County's wildfire recovery and entrenched issues like homelessness and the high cost of living, the Film Commission cites its own 5-year study that found each tax credit dollar generates at least $24.40 in spending. The state's nonpartisan legislative analyst's office calls the tax credit a valid tool for protecting Hollywood's market share, but says there is weak evidence it will benefit the state's overall economy. How has the president weighed in on Hollywood? President Trump took office with Hollywood on his agenda. In January, he appointed film veterans John Voight, Sylvester Stallone, and Mel Gibson as special envoys. He posted, "For the purpose of bringing Hollywood, which has lost much business over the last 4 years, to foreign countries, back." Tariffs were one of the envoys' recommendations, which included federal tax incentives and subsidies for production companies. The tariff idea met quick blowback from entertainment insiders who denounced them as unenforceable and out of touch with the globally networked way that movies are produced and viewed. And Governor Newsom leaned into it, suggesting a collaboration with the president for a $7.5 billion federal tax credit. President Trump later said there were no final decisions and all options are being explored. Even if they don't agree with the tariffs, Hollywood insiders welcome the help. for better or worse, whatever Trump is thinking. I applaud that he's saying, okay, Hollywood should remain intact, says Dr. Sharma. How are other states and countries luring film production? Countries like Canada, Hungary, Australia, and the UK have been luring film and TV production away from California for decades. So have other states like Georgia, North Carolina, and New Jersey. Tax incentives are a big draw. They're all talking about rebates, says Alvin Lieberman, executive director of the Entertainment Media and Technology Initiative at New York University's Stern School of Business. You know, come to Malaysia, come to Nepal, come to India, and so they're all offering it, he says, describing what he saw in Cannes, France, where he attended the eponymous film festival. The United Kingdom, for instance, offers a 25.5% tax rebate on 80% of a production's expenditures in the UK, with higher rebates for animated or independent films. Qualifying expenses include above-the-line talent. According to the British Film Commission, US investment in UK productions went up 83% from 2023 to 2024. More than half of US states offer tax credits, ranging from 20 to 40% of qualifying expenses. Another 10 states offer other incentives. Georgia's program is one of the most successful. The Peach State allows a 20% tax credit, plus an additional 10% if the production makes qualified references to the state. It is more straightforward than California's and has no cap. The production ship has not yet sailed, says Professor Sharma, although its tethers are fraying. LA still has what he calls the two E's. It's effective and efficient, along with a third, evil E, it's expensive. Any incentive that helps bring down the production costs will help, Professor Offenberg says. People want to shoot here, he says. It's just the cost difference is so big right now. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, June the 19th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, thanks for listening. Good night.